Today, we'll be touching on a topic familiar to many criminal justice advocates, the 13th Amendment. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States. What you just heard was the exception clause to the 13th Amendment, which has been used to justify forced labor in U.S. prisons since the 19th century. In recent years, a movement among criminal legal system reformists has emerged to end this wholly unethical practice. But the meaning of punishment for a crime is also important. Is it legal to force labor upon someone who has finished serving their sentence? What about carceral settings that the government claims are not about punishment? What about shadow prisons? Welcome back to Shadow Prisons Unveiled, where we uncover the hidden world of shadow prisons and the lives caught within them. Today we'll be delving into the complex labor practices and fraught monetary policies employed in U.S. shadow prisons. We will begin in Texas, where Jennifer Williams, a mother, and Clarence Brown, a former shadow prisoner, are both fighting to end unjust civil commitment. What is a shadow prison for those that don't know?
So my definition of a shadow prison is basically a post-incarceration detainment facility that is unlawfully detaining men for imaginary future crimes.
That was Jennifer Williams, a Texas mother, mail carrier, and committed advocate. Her son, Justin, was incarcerated when he was just 17 years old. And when it came time for him to be released, he was instead indefinitely confined at Texas's shadow prison. So in our past conversations, we've talked about your son, Justin, and his experience of being held indefinitely, being refused the option to have a job. This is significant because labor is deeply connected to Texas's shadow prisoners' hope of release. Walk us through why this is important.
So it's a five-tier program, and while you're in tier four, you must save between $8,000 to $10,000 before you can leave the facility. You can be completely finished with all of your program work and still not have enough money saved up to leave.
So even though labor isn't mandatory, they need to work to get out. That sounds like slave labor.
Yeah, it definitely does. It definitely does. And it's not just that, but they take 25% of all money sent to all of the men unless it is sent to you by your spouse. So unless you are married to that person, whatever money you send into the men, they will expect you to either mail a money order to Austin for 25% of that amount, or they will take 25% off the top of that before your loved one gets it.
The minimum wage in Texas is only $7.25. So that's around $550, putting taxes aside.
If you do the math on that, I mean, the men, they don't work 40 hours a week. You know, it's not a permanent job. They have to switch out positions because there's only so many jobs and there's 500 plus men there. And I'm going to guess at this number between 80 and 100 men that are in tier four that are able to work.
As of November 5th, 2024, there were actually only 27 people in tier four. So that means there's 27 people able to work for money out of a total of 598.
It's just a joke. So they're switching out jobs every 6 months, and then they sort of sit and wait for another 6 months to start working again. It would take a very long time, save up $10,000, like $5 an hour, working 6 months at a time.
We've actually done the math on that. Let's say they work 20 hours a week at that rate of $5.50 an hour for 6 months, which is approximately 24 weeks. That's 20 times $5.50 times 24, which is $2,640. You'd have to work for 4 years to reach that number. And that's not even accounting for taxes. So Jennifer, a debtor's prison is a prison for those who can't afford to pay their financial debts. How do these shadow prisons compare to debtor's prisons?
I think that it would qualify as a debtor's prison, given the fact that there are men sitting there right now who are ready to be moved into the community, into Tier 5, but they don't have the amount of money that Marcy McLean wants them to have in order to leave. And you're not allowed to ask families to donate any money to that savings. You just have to have it before you can leave.
Marcia McLean is the director of the TCCO, the Texas Civil Commitment Office, also known as TCO, which oversees the shadow prison there. Critics say she is the authoritarian hand that steers life at Texas's shadow prison. Unlike the other 19 states with shadow prisons, Texas is unique in that TCO is not even symbolically housed within the state mental health agency. Instead, TCO reports directly to Texas Governor Greg Abbott, at least on paper. In practice, critics say she seems accountable to no one.
Now, it is a for-profit facility, but they're always asking for money.
So you're saying that these facilities are for-profit, paid for by the state, subsidized off the backs of the families of shadow prisoners, and yet are routinely paying their prisoners who help the facility operate less than minimum wage?
Yes. Yes. In a treatment facility. Yes. And you still have to pay thousands of dollars to an attorney, go to court, which takes years to get out of there. It's all punishment. All of it's punishment.
After hearing this, I knew I had to speak with a current Texas shadow prisoner about what Jennifer had told me. Texas's shadow prison only lets contacts approved by the administration talk to current shadow prisoners. But we were able to speak with Cade Wilson, who was in a county jail for a rule infraction at the Texas facility. This was a rare peek through the cone of silence and secrecy that often surrounded the shadow prison.
Get 6 months on, 6 months off, and they do pay you a federal minimum wage. But like I said, then you have to turn around and reimburse the state of Texas 25%.
So you're paying tax on the money TCO is skimming off the top. Have you found it easy to save that money?
When you get to Tier 4, they do provide a way for you to save money. But the problem is that they constantly will find any reason to knock you back down. And it's almost impossible to get out from that threshold. In the last 9 years, probably about 1% have actually left through the program.
When I ask people familiar with the Texas system of indefinite detention, the release numbers are bleak. According to the most recent state report, there are only 5 people on conditional release. An additional 5 are in state hospitals or support living centers, with 35 having died behind the walls. You can read more about Cade's experience at ajustfuture.org. AJUSTFUTURE. Another conversation, this time with Clarence Brown, who was fully released from the Texas Shadow Prison in 2024. Reveals that the practice of taking money from shadow prisoners goes deeper than just their earnings.
They took anything, they took everything from your work pay to money that your family sent to you, money that you received from lawsuits or money that you received from inheritances, all that kind of stuff. As a matter of fact, when I want to send my money to my bank, they told me that I couldn't, and the staff would not give me my check. I had to sign it over to them in order to get my money.
Clarence is the 4th person I spoke to who alleged that without $10,000 sitting in your TCO account, Release is impossible.
Some of us only needed less than $5,000. When I left with close to $15,000. So there's some guys that left with less than that. But now they're saying guys that have they have to have at least $10,000 to leave the facility.
But where is this written down? No document plainly states that someone must save $10,000 working part-time for the state before they can leave.
They won't put it out. They will not put it out. They will not put that out. Like I said, when I was there, there was no such thing. As a matter of fact, you just sit there and wait until they're ready for you to go. You know, I mean, it didn't matter how much money you had.
Why not?
I think because it would be scrutinized pretty heavily because of the fact that it would show that the program is a failure just on the space, because if the guys have $10,000 and if you're tier two and tier three and can't work, then when are you going to leave?
This exact policy might not be written out word for word, but we found a policy statement that comes pretty close. TECO policy number 5.2 on transition to home plan. A copy of the client's most recent bank statements that reflect 3 months' worth of saved living expenses. That's the text, verbatim. In theory, this requirement for reentry is a safeguard to ensure released individuals don't fall flat on their face upon reentering the free world. But in practice, it appears to be one of the countless rules that keep men confined for years or decades beyond their original sentences. Imagine that. You're told you're ready to leave, that you've completed all of your mandated treatment, that you've done everything required of you. And then suddenly, a new requirement appears, unwritten but absolute. You need money. You need to work for less than minimum wage. You need to contribute to the very system that has kept you locked inside, a system that costs taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars per person locked away, and will continue to cost taxpayers that money because it refuses to let you out. According to Clarence, the facility wasn't just exploiting its labor force. It was engaging in potential fraud.
In 2017, he started making us fill out forms stating that we were contract workers. We were filling out 1099 saying we're contract workers, when in fact we were employees. If you are told when to work, where to work, and if you're provided the tools to work, then you're an employee as opposed to a contract worker. A contract worker sets their own hours. An employee doesn't get to set their own hours, so we didn't set our own hours. We were told when to work, how long to work, and what we were working.
By categorizing these detainees, who, according to the courts, are not prisoners, but instead people receiving rehabilitative services, as contract workers, the facility can avoid payroll taxes, benefits, and worker protections that come with standard employment practices. And while these facilities dodge financial obligations, they still are deducting money from these individuals' paychecks. Current and former shadow prisoners have filed suit regarding these monetary practices, often on the basis that they violate the Fair Labor Standards Act, or the FLSA. This federal law is the basis of minimum wage and other labor regulations for employees in the private sector, as well as the government. Courts have repeatedly ruled against shadow prisoners, arguing that they are not employees under the FLSA. They tend to argue that no employer-employee relationship exists between detainees and the shadow prison that houses them. In other words, the courts do not consider the labor the shadow prisoners do to be employment. Civil rights advocates reject this reasoning. They argue that the economic reality of the work they perform, its compulsory nature, its necessity for release, and its financial burden on families, meets the definition of employment under labor laws. The legal battles over labor in shadow prisons reveal a system caught in contradiction, one that both demands work from those confined and denies them the legal protections of employment. Across multiple cases, we see a pattern. Civil commitment facilities sidestepping labor laws,
while the individuals inside struggle against financial barriers that seem designed to keep them locked away.
To help make sense of all of these findings, I spoke with Molly Pchenik, a staff attorney at the Texas Civil Rights Project, who I hope would be able to provide some insight into what we're hearing.
My name is Molly Pchenik. I am a staff attorney at Texas Civil Rights Project, and we work on behalf of marginalized Texans at all stages of the criminal legal process to minimize the harms of the carceral system.
These facilities, the shadow prisons, see people paid below minimum wage, forced to work to leave, and in some cases having upwards of $1 million in assets seized by the state. Do you see this in the rest of the criminal legal system?
I have not seen that elsewhere in the criminal legal system. In the criminal context of incarceration, a prison sentence has an end date. When that end date comes, a person is released regardless of the savings that they have and regardless of their ability to support themselves upon release. I am not familiar personally with this specific tactic, with the need to bank huge sums of money, all the while your money being taken, funneled off to cover, quote unquote, cover costs.
What are the consequences for the American people of accepting the indefinite detainment of certain individuals after a prison sentence?
I think this is just another example of people's liberties being taken away. People who find themselves in civil commitment are generally marginalized, unpopular politically, and those are always the easiest people to go after, the easiest people to target. And, you know, it's a cliche now, but, you know, it just starts with the unpopular groups, and where does it end?
Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime. This is the line in the 13th Amendment that has enabled forced prison labor for over a century. But on paper, shadow prisons aren't prisons at all. The Supreme Court has permitted the use of these post-sentence civil confinement laws only for the purpose of treatment. They call it different names, mental health support, treatment. The understanding is that these are not about punishment. So if shadow prisons aren't punishment for crime, then the exceptional clause of the 13th Amendment doesn't apply. Instead, the courts have relied on the idea that work inside these facilities is rehabilitative, not exploitative. In other words, the courts argue that rather than serving the institution, the labor shadow prisoners are required to do is part of their treatment plan that the institution claims will make these individuals safe to reenter society. Clarence Brown, who we spoke with earlier, actually was able to leave the Texas shadow prison. This is what he has to say about the premise that this was a treatment program.
All this crap and shit that McLean and them put people through, to me, that's not treatment. I think at the end of the day, treatment is supposed to be able to help you be able to become a better person. Look back on your experiences, take a deep breath and say, hey, okay, I don't want to do that again. I don't want to be that person again. All of the punishment and stuff that goes on, that's not treatment. None of that's treatment.
This preventative detention is largely unprecedented. As a result, it's difficult to look for analogs in other areas of the legal system. Shadow prisoners simply haven't won court cases. However, similar legal reasoning has successfully been challenged before. In Washington State versus Geo Group, a judge found that for-profit detention facility owed money to the state on behalf of immigrant detainees who participated in a so-called voluntary work program.
These individuals were paid just $1 a day, far below Washington's minimum wage of $11 per hour. The court ruled that this was a violation of state labor laws. The contrast is striking. When it came to the detention of immigrants, a court ruled that underpaid detainees deserved fair wages. But in civil commitment cases, shadow prisons, courts continue to deny similar protections. The facility claims the work is voluntary, of course, and that it is part of their treatment program. They claim civil commitment is not punishment, and yet individuals like Clarence and Cade describe an experience indistinguishable from incarceration. I asked Molly about these contradictions.
The courts have been reluctant and so far have refused to classify these detainees as employees under labor laws, specifically the FLSA. The Supreme Court itself has ruled that these facilities are perfectly legal, and so long as they're not used to punish, they can remain. But we've seen that, in effect, they are in fact penal facilities. All you need to do is listen to the voices of the countless people trapped inside or the family members of these individuals. How do we work around the double standards that seem to be present in the judicial system?
I think the first step is just educating the public and our leaders. It's so easy to forget the humanity of these folks, and I think if more people understood that humanity, there would hopefully be a lot more compassion for them. I think that there is really an information problem that people, legislators, don't really understand how broad a group of people this is. And even setting aside the hope that our leaders have compassion for everyone, I think there's just a misconception of who can end up in prison, who can end up in civil commitment, who can end up in solitary confinement, who can end up in any of these forms of confinement. I've been surprised going to hearings or being in these situations with leaders that just the gap in understanding of what folks in these situations have gone through to end up there. Humanizing people is always the first step. We do a lot of information requests in our work. In Texas, that's the Texas Public Information Act. The more people know, the more they have access to the documents and regulations and rules and understanding of what their, tax dollars are going to support and to prop up, the more people can be informed and invested in pushing the people in power to live up to their responsibilities to protect the people that are in the custody of the state.
That was Molly Pechenik of the Texas Civil Rights Project. If you're interested in learning more about the work they're doing, you can look them up at txcivilrights.org. That's texascivilrights.org. Thanks for being on the podcast today, Molly.
Sure. Happy to be here and happy to talk.
So what does this all mean? It means that the courts are hesitant to challenge the murky legal status of shadow prisons. It means that the guise of treatment can be used to indefinitely confine people under civil law, where they can extract labor without consequence. It means that in practice, many people inside these facilities are trapped, not just by law, but by poverty. And it means that the only way to change these systems might lie outside the courthouse and in the realm of public opinion. Shadow prisons operate in secrecy, targeting marginalized individuals and tearing families apart. But they thrive because too few people know they exist. If you've been moved by the stories and facts shared here today, visit our website, www.ajustfuture.org. That's A-J-U
STFUTURE. We've published an info packet to accompany this audio piece about how to advocate for just financial practices in shadow prisons. Remember what Molly said about the value of education. Reach out to your local representatives. Share these stories with your friends and family. Demand transparency in these systems. Let's stand with all of the families still waiting for a just future. Visit ajustfuture.org for resources, advocacy tools, and ways to get involved.